Welcome to We Are Libertarians. My name is Creighton Harrington. Across from me is Mr. Chris Spangle, and to his right, my left, is Mr. Chris Galt. This is our third podcast. Sorry I was absent for the last one. I was out in Florida enjoying myself instead of in this wonderfully cold state until the day I left, and then it was comfortable.
And you don't look like you got any sun. You looked as pale as you did when you left. Pale,
yep. You know what? Whatever. I was actually burnt for a while. I'm actually fairly dark compared to my normal complexion. Don't hate me, I'm Irish. I guess today, it was in the news this in the last few days, the House GOP, Paul Ryan and company, released their new budget. And I felt like it would be excellent place to start, being that that is probably the number one issue in America, is economy. So I was wondering what your guys' take was on whether or not Paul Ryan and the House GOP are doing a good job at addressing the debt issue. I from what I understand, that the projected time that the budget is balanced is like 2040, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's... And just to add to this, Rand Paul released another budget in the Senate that balances the budget again in 5 years and reduces and cuts two or three departments. So is in comparison, it's just, you know, take that, keep that in mind when you when you're thinking about it. So, Galt, what do you think?
I think that the GOP plan is too slow. I don't think it does enough fast enough. I don't think our economic system is sustainable till 2040. At this level, pulling up the exact specifics on the plan, says that they're going to cut safety net programs for the poor, deep cuts for the safety net programs for the poor, with politically risky cuts in Medicare.
Which risky cuts in Medicare? Who's writing that? Democrats
or the Huffington Post?
Okay, there you go. Like they're going to kill old people with their plan.
Well, it actually says many Democrats have allied with this plan because they need bipartisanship to do something about the economy.
I don't think that's going to last. And the reason I say that is they made a – I believe it was Ron Paul that made the point. I don't know where I read it. But it doesn't touch defense. It doesn't even touch it.
Well, of course not. Republicans put it forward.
I mean, I know. I think we understand that old mantra. But, I mean, while they may have some Democratic support now – I don't see it as having a strong support in the future.
No, anytime something like this gets introduced, it becomes a political football. And then once it becomes the political football, then they have to fight each other. There can be no bipartisanship, and I think that's that's the biggest reason that our credit got downgraded last year, is where's the bipartisanship to make sure that we survive as a country?
Yeah, and I just saw an update on my phone the other day that it's only been 3 years now, and Obama has already surpassed the total amount of debt added than Bush did in his entire 8 years, and he hasn't even finished his term up yet. So, I mean, yeah, you're right. They're going to fight each other because they're not really in it, in my view.
It's an election year. I mean, that's why you see the Iran ratcheting up. That's why you see these big plans being introduced, and that's why you'll see fighting about it. But, I mean, as far as my opinion on the plan, I haven't really looked into it that in depth, but anything that gets these guys talking about how they can cut more and spend less, I'm for it. I think it obviously doesn't go far enough. It's not as big as libertarians would like, but at this point, anything's got to take place, and I agree with Ron Paul that you should start with defense first. So that would be probably my biggest criticism is the lack of defense cutting.
But as a caveat to that, while I think we would all agree that it's not nearly as much as we would like, you have all this talk about Paul Ryan's budget plan and the House GOP and all this, and at the same time, you have Rand Paul releasing a very much more, you know, I think towards our way kind of budget plan, much more realistic, that takes into account the fact that, you know, we can't last till 2040 at this rate. He releases it, and there's almost no news coverage of it. I mean, did you guys even hear about it before I said anything?
I did, only because Jack Hunter did a YouTube video about how it's being ignored.
Right, so you heard it through libertarian media.
Right. Yeah. I didn't hear it through regular media at all.
Yeah, so I mean, so you have this, you know, much more, you know, realistic and bold plan, and this is a, going into an election year where the biggest things that people are complaining about Obama is spending the economy. And you have a Republican in the Senate who was elected pretty much by the Tea Party, and he releases this very bold plan that is in direct, you know, opposition to President Obama. And instead we're talking about, you know, some measly little plan that's going to cut stuff and maybe make it balanced in 2040 if there's growth that's the way they want and everything goes through. And it's probably from projected increases and not from actual spending as it is right now.
Right. And that's always the tricky part of that. Did Rand have a press conference or – okay, so he had a press conference because that's part of the deal. If you don't get media coverage, you have to make it a bigger spectacle next time.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the clips of his press conference. He gave a press conference for the one he released last year.
Right.
And I don't remember hearing much about it on, like, you know, mainstream media either. So what do you make of that? I mean, it's pretty it's glaringly obvious that there are Republicans in the Congress that are willing to address this on a realistic level. Yet the mainstream media makes this deal that, you know, the budget and the spending, that's all the big thing. Yet they talk about these, you know, really, I mean, they're just wussy cuts is really what they are.
Well, I think that it shows that the next election, Rand Paul is going to be treated no differently than Ron Paul. A lot of libertarians think that the GOP is going to take Rand Paul more seriously than Ron Paul, but they'll probably treat him the exact same way and ignore him or call him crazy.
I think it has more to say about the media, I as far as you've got to get there first. You've got to be the one that comes up with the idea first. And if you're not, then it's sort of you become an also-ran. And if you want to have your plan noticed, then we'd be sitting here saying, well, what about Paul Ryan's plan? Why didn't they cover Paul Ryan's plan? I think that that's – have you guys seen Game Change on HBO?
No, not yet.
All right.
I want to.
You're still looking for an HBO Go account?
Yes, I am. If anyone can help me out.
Yeah. It talks about, you know, listen, you gave a bad interview, Sarah Palin. Don't worry. In 24 hours, the cycle's going to be totally different. We're going to be, you know, in 48 hours after the debates or the convention speech, we'll be talking about something totally different. And Rand Paul probably shouldn't have released his within a 24-hour span of Paul Ryan releasing his, especially when Paul Ryan is a media darling, where Rand Paul is somewhat of a media darling, but more towards the conservative press. Paul Ryan will just sort of has that the media's respect.
I think it's a fact that the GOP plan doesn't have a chance to pass this year with a Democratic Senate and majority. This is
about a bunch of Republican House members who want to show that they're serious about cutting spending in an election year, and then they can go back and just like Dick Lugar's doing right now and saying, I supported Paul Ryan's budget, I wanted to cut it, and you know I even support Rand Paul's budget, and we should go further. I mean, you know, it's posturing.
Now, I, unfortunately, in my car, I often listen to 93.1 here in Indy, and that is from noon to 3.
You're talking about competing radio stations? You should be listening to podcasts.
Are we real? Oh.
No, I'm just kidding.
Mr. Limbaugh comes on during those hours, and I know he is no friend of libertarians on a number of issues. But I have to give the man credit that he does understand politics in general to a large extent. And he made a very interesting observation that there is a possibility that with the reactions of the Democrats with this budget plan, that they could be showing a sense of maybe they're holding Obama's feet to the fire, for lack of a better term. They're not, you know, just going along with whatever he says. Obama's been running this do-nothing Congress campaign, and a lot of Congress is Democrats, and, you know, they feel like they're getting thrown under the bus, and they're kind of pushing back. Do you feel like you see any of that happening at all in Congress right now?
I think that it's a smart move if you're a Democrat to start distancing yourself from Obama. Look at his polling numbers. I mean, you know, Republicans did that to Bush, especially in his second term. If it looks like there could be a House or a Senate bloodbath, you want to start walking back. You want, you know, politicians love to be mavericky. They love to be independents. They love to say that, you know, I went out and I bucked the party trend on this issue. And, you know, and especially when you have an unpopular president. I mean, they'll try to hide every photo of them having their arm around Obama in 2007.
Yeah, well, our Young Americans for Liberty group at IPOI this week did the debt clock that we were talking about. And we held a Pass the Mic event on Tuesday, and we talked about, you know, the debt, the economy. We compared and contrasted Obama's plan to Ron Paul's Restore America plan. And the majority of the students that came and talked actually liked Ron Paul's plan a lot more and thought that it was what we needed, which surprised me because I thought more students would be with Obama just because he's Obama. And when people looked at the specifics of the plan, when we actually compared them, the specific numbers, everybody thought Ron Paul's plan was
much better.
What
are some of the differences?
Obama wasn't going to cut any departments. Paul was going to cut five or eliminate five.
As the now famous, it's an inside joke on the within the Libertarian Party offices. Five with the claw hand, like for the
no, it's five.
And then he has his hands like, all right, if you're driving in your car, take your right hand, stick it in the air, and act like you're going to palm a basketball. That's how Ron Paul holds up five fingers.
It was very funny.
But to another point, I was trying to get to was, like I said, I'm no friend of Rush Limbaugh, but he did make some interesting points. He pointed out George Will had a column where he was explaining, he was kind of trying to make it seem like, or I guess people interpreted it as saying that we shouldn't, that Republicans, conservatives, Republicans, quote, shouldn't be looking at so much at the presidential race because there is a strong possibility that Democrats are distancing themselves from Obama in an effort to retake the House and Senate. And therefore, even if we get a Republican Republican president, it will be almost to no avail. And again, this is a Republican saying this, so I'm not saying Republican would be any better than Obama if it's Romney or something. But he was pointing out that if we get a different president than Obama, and we have a House and a Senate that are just totally, you know, total Democrat because of this, you know, this tactic or whatever that you want to call it that the Democrats might be possibly pursuing. It's like, what would we do then? He's like, so he's saying we need to focus on the House and Senate. And so that's kind of like what I'm saying. Do you think that that's kind of happening? Do you see as there being a pushback from Obama just so that there can be a retake of the House and Senate? And would you prefer that? Because I know that one good thing about broken split party divided government is gridlock, as far as I'm concerned, because then they don't pass any more oppressive legislation.
I think, you know, historically, what happens in a president's second term is that they move a little bit more towards the center. They come, if they're, you know, you look at Clinton, he moved a little bit more right. You know, he was more conservative than Bush was for the most part, especially in that second term. And, you know, you hear all the time that, oh, well, Obama in his second term is just going to take the brakes off. And that's not, that doesn't really jive with history very well.
You don't see as maybe there being a possibility that with all this saber rattling against Iran, that if Obama wins again, then he's like, well, now would be the time, because even if Iran is an unpopular move,
you've got three ways to get us out of this debt. Okay, the first way is you've got to raise taxes a lot. You've got to cut spending, number two. Or number three, you get us into a war. There's no willingness on either side to really do the first two. I mean, I think that, again, I'm probably the most cynical of the three of us, and I just don't see how we avoid a war. And I don't think they look at it as a national safety issue. I think it's another big stimulus project for them, because then they can pump money back into the economy through armaments and through the military-industrial complex.
And that's the argument they've been using since, you know, John Maynard Keynes sat down and wrote his famous book, The General Theory. But you don't think that there's a possible trend, you know, mainstream trend away from that? You don't feel that? I mean, I know we feel it because we're libertarians, but you don't see it as being a little bit larger?
I think your average person absolutely 100% is opposed to war with Iran. I think most people are. I think your hardcore Republicans are all for it because they buy into the idea that we've got to go attack every country in the Middle East to protect ourselves. But I think by and large, most people, the 70% of the population that doesn't vote, does not want us in another war.
I don't think it matters. We're going to war.
Well, you may be getting more cynical than I am.
Obamacare wasn't popular either.
Right.
So, talking about Obamacare.
I think that if we can get through this election cycle with no bombs flying, we may be okay. Okay, because it is an election year. So otherwise, I don't know.
All the GOP candidates are running on repealing Obamacare. If Obama's reelected, will that ever happen?
I mean, I don't. The thing I have as far as when it comes to like Ron Paul versus the others, and this show hopefully doesn't just emerge into being a Ron Paul love fest. But one of the reasons why I think that I just don't take I don't take any other candidate seriously as far as what they're going to do is because they have no history of ever being anything but a party player. And I feel like you asked that question. I think if Mitt Romney gets elected, I do not believe for one second that anything that he does during his presidency will be remotely close to what he campaigned on. I mean, for the love of God, George W. Bush ran on a campaign of a humble foreign policy. George W. Bush did. I mean, the presidency, if Mitt Romney gets elected, he'll do something, and then he'll, through some sort of mental gymnastics, explain how this was definitely what I promised my campaign, or he'll just go, oh, well, the times have changed. I had to change my platform.
The Etch-a-Sketch candidate, called now, which is actually pretty funny. And we could talk about that next. So if you want to talk about the Etch-a-Sketch president in a minute, I think that a lot of times it is popular to go out and campaign on this kind of stuff, like we're going to repeal Obamacare, and they will put it up for a vote and it'll fail, and then they'll say, well, see, those darn Democrats, these big government programs, they don't ever really, you never get enough numbers. It's not that the Republicans don't try, or some policy on the other side, they don't try. It's just that they can never get to a number that will actually repeal it. It's just sort of how the nature of government works. And so do I think that Obamacare gets repealed through Congress in, probably our lifetimes? Maybe, maybe not. I think I seriously doubt it, though. Where it will fail is the courts, especially with a conservative court,
That brings me greatly to the next point, the next topic of conversation, which is the constitutionality of Obamacare will be on Monday in the Supreme Court. You say Monday?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's right around the corner. What do you think the chances are? I know they're saying that it's possible that it might actually pass the Supreme Court because of Scalia and, of course, because of Kennedy. But what do you think on that?
Expand on that. They think why would Scalia
Scalia in his past had an opinion that was relatively, friendly to the argument that the Obamacare team is going to present in the Supreme Court. And they're saying that, will Scalia follow that same line of thought now when it comes up? And then, of course, Kennedy has always been the middle-of-the-road guy that you can really get with any, pushing and prodding. So they think that they might actually have the numbers to get the mandate passed through the Supreme Court.
Well, just the discussion of numbers shows you what I really believe about Supreme Courts. It's mostly political. These Supreme Court decisions are more political than anything else. If you look at the recent Charlie White case, they ruled in favor of Charlie White and the Republican Party. If they had ruled against Charlie White, then that would mean that the Democrats won the office and that the Libertarian Party got 13 or 16% of the vote and that they become the second political party and the Libertarian Party of Indiana would start filling out election boards. And it was very clear that Charlie White had intent to defraud the voters. So the Indiana Supreme Court looks at this and says, well, politically this would be a bad move. It would mean that we'd overturn the status quo. So even though it's pretty clear that what we're judging, that we really should go the other way, we're going to do the politically right thing and keep the status quo. And I think a lot of times people think that the Supreme Court, because libertarians are rule of law people, so we expect the people who rule on laws to think in rule of law terms, but they largely don't. They think in political terms a lot of times. And I think that just because Scalia in the past was friendly to an argument, I think that Scalia is a conservative person and probably, when he goes into the booth, votes for the Republican Party. And he's probably going to vote to overturn Obamacare. I mean, because it's the political thing to do, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, it sounds to me like the Wall Street Journal thinks it's going to make it through the Supreme Court.
It's going to pass?
Yes, because they think that they're going to rule that the Commerce Clause, that looks at the ends and not the means. So the individual mandate is part of the necessary and proper because it's necessary and proper to use the individual mandate to reach their ends, which are constitutional by the Commerce Clause because they can regulate interstate commerce, and national health care is in between the states.
But can they add to the Constitution and say that there's a new requirement to be a legal U.S. citizen? I mean, that to me is the fundamental question, is you're now requiring something of every United States citizen to be legal, and that's not in the Constitution whatsoever.
That's a good point, but to what Spangle was saying a minute ago, do you think that, I mean, the Wall Street Journal sounds like they're using a law argument. They're using an argument that this is the law, whereas Spangle just made the point that, you know, it's very political.
Article was written by two lawyers.
Well,
so
there you go.
But
yeah, well, then it must be right.
Well, I think that as the Supreme Court, they're supposed to look at issues
based
on the law.
I mean, I'm not saying supposed, you know, they're
right.
I wish
Spangle thinks to look at it politically.
Yeah, I agree to an extent that they do look at it politically. I mean, each president picks the Supreme Court justice they think is going to be friendly to their point of view. But at the same time, I feel like the constitutionality argument, the Commerce Clause argument, as it's been used in American history, is very different than the argument that the Obama administration is trying to push. You made a good point. You have to be a legal citizen is, I mean, I don't know if they're going to use that argument. I doubt it. But I think the fundamental thing is going to come down to is, like, can the government force you to take action as far as purchasing something for yourself? And I've never heard of a single argument on a federal level that's ever come into, you know, legal dispute, that there's ever been that kind of argument presented. And I think personally that it will, I would say I'm 55-45 that it will be overturned. I'm very, very in the middle there because I know how you know, big of a decision it is. And it will be one of the most quoted Supreme Court cases in history, you know, for the 21st century.
You think it's on par with Brown versus the Board of Education or Dred Scott?
It may not be that big, but it's going to be one of them ones when you're, you know, 50 years from now, you're going to be in your political science class and they're going to talk about some doctrine that came out of this case.
See, I almost think that it could be on par with that because this is the government. I mean, this is such... Obamacare is such a huge usurpation of power. I mean, it is telling you that you have to buy a product. The government, the federal government, is forcing you to buy a product. And that's not something that has ever been tried, really. I mean, this is sort of a case that defines whether or not the federal government is, you know, if they're allowed to be the overarching beast that libertarians think that they are. You know, so I think that it could possibly be on par with Brown versus the Board of Education or something like Dred Scott.
I think it depends on the outcome. If it gets overturned, the status quo hasn't necessarily changed. If it does go through, then it's actually the doctrine that came out of it was the government can force you to buy stuff, and then it will be huge. So I think it depends on the outcome, because if it gets overturned, everybody's like, well, everything's back to normal then. And if it doesn't, then you've got some new, you know, argument, some new
And what I'm saying is it's like Marshall versus I mean, it is the case that will allow the government, the federal government, to start just going out of control. And I mean, and it's really sort of the if they don't rule in favor of the Constitution here, then really we're moving into an era where the Constitution literally means nothing. Like, we can just openly scoff at it. You know, at least they try and fake it now, where they all fake having pocket constitutions. What do you think?
Well, I feel like I'm forced to buy things all the time by the government, like car insurance and driver's licenses.
Well, just to make a separation there, you're talking about the state government.
Well, right. It's still government.
It's still government, but yeah. From a specifically legal perspective, state and federal are different. I know to right. us, and in real terms, it is not different because it's still the same effect on us. But as far as a legal situation, they are different.
Right.
It's just still government forcing me to buy something, to do something.
But do you not feel
healthcare is just forcing me to buy healthcare?
But do you not feel
in America
that having
forced to go to jury duty is the same thing, is it not?
No, it is the same thing. It is still forcing you to do something. My point is that as far as a legal perspective, this will open the door for Washington, D.C. to essentially dictate the products you have in your house, who makes them, where they came from. I mean, it's like a protectionist's dream to have this passed, because all they have to say is that it's illegal to buy. You have to buy, you know, cars made in America. You have to buy. Or let's say that we get into a dispute with some foreign country and we want to help out their ally, and they, let's say it's Israel and they make a lot of flowers. You have to buy Israel-grown flowers. I mean, it's really just, it opens the door for so much over, I mean, and just the bureaucratic arm that will have to grow out of it. And the just, I mean, it's really just, I feel like it is incredibly dangerous, and it's on a federal level. Now, the state, I mean, the only benefit of it being on a state level is that it's confined to that state.
And you can choose to move out of that state. I mean, functionally, though, I think every state has that requirement to have car insurance, though.
You can choose to move out of the country as well.
Now we're getting. I could choose to move to Mars with Newt Gingrich, but that's probably not going to happen. I mean, that's, you know, I want to be an American. Mexico doesn't really sound that great to me today.
All right, let's say it's overturned. That means it's null and void, the whole thing.
It depends.
They're taking on a certain specific part of it.
They are, and they're. I don't know if they've made the decision on whether or not, if they overturn that mandate, they have to overturn the whole legislation, or if they overturn the mandate, they just overturn the mandate.
Historically, haven't we seen the president go against the will of the Supreme Court, like FDR?
FDR did when they kept overturning New Deal programs.
Right, and he just did them anyway.
But he didn't put in many of those Supreme Court justices. No, he didn't just do them anyway.
He said he was going to increase
the number of chairs,
right.
And then he would
to 14,
yeah,
or yes. something.
And he said he would just put his guys in there, and then they got scared and they started going his way.
Okay. I think it was at that time it was 6, and he was going to make it like 15.
Okay,
and
put all his people
in there, right. And it became it was the deciding moment when they decided Congress. Even Democrats decided that we need to limit the amount of time that a president is in power, because once you start threatening to control another branch of the government, that's when it's like, ooh, you know.
Well, do either of you guys know the case Gibbons v. Ogden?
I've heard of it
in con law this week when we were talking about the Commerce Clause.
Is that the
It was basically the first case that the Supreme Court ruled that the Commerce Clause is so expansive.
Is that the steamboat one?
Yes.
Okay.
So do you think that this ruling is...
Well, expand on that, because most of our listeners probably don't know what the steamboat one means.
That's the one in the New York steamboat Vanderbilt and all that, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what it was who's the guy that invented the steamboat? It was
Steamboat Willie.
No. Who invented the steamboat? What was his name? Robert Fulton. Robert Fulton. Okay. So,
yes.
So Robert Fulton, who invented the steamboat, was actually, he had a monopoly permit, a monopoly protection.
For all of the water
of the Hudson River in New York. He was the only company allowed to transport cargo, transport passengers on the Hudson River in New York. Vanderbilt, of the railroad baron Vanderbilt, which I say baron because that's how they know him. I don't think he was a baron. But Vanderbilt was, before he got into railroads, he started running a steamboat. And he ran it in the Hudson River, and he continually, you know, basically made Robert Fulton look like a fool. He was able to, even with Robert Fulton's monopoly protection, Vanderbilt was able to cut prices. He got way more business. At one point, he cut prices so low that he let passengers ride his boat for free, hoping they would buy food. I mean, he kept the prices low. He right. kept them down the entire time he was doing it. Well, Robert Fulton, of course, said, no, I have legal protection to do this.
Right.
And he took it to court, and it got all the way to the Supreme Court, and it got overturned. And it said that you can't have monopoly protection of this. That's not fair. It's not right. And they overturned it. And, of course, Robert Fulton soon went out of business. But
right. It was basically saying that the federal government can step in over a state law about their own commerce.
Yes.
Basically.
So how do I feel like it's related to that?
Yes.
It will be related to that if they take that step.
Right. If they pass it and say it's okay, then it's going to expand the Commerce Clause even more.
Exactly. That's the fear. Right.
That's what we're saying is now the federal government can take that role where they're now to be a legal U.S. citizen, you have to start buying product, and they can start telling you what. They can already kind of tell you what products you can and can't buy, and they can do that with tariffs too. I mean, they're trying to make you buy American tires because they're trying to limit the amount of Chinese tires that come in. So,
and it's not like we're saying that, you know, all these other ways of controlling how people buy stuff is okay, but this one step is going to be, that's the last straw. I mean, I would say that all of it is messed up, but I just see, you know, if you look into the future, the logical, you know, end of what will come out of this, you know, if this passes, is just, it's very scary. It's very, very, very prevalent. It'll be, I think it's extremely dangerous. And I really don't understand why, I don't know, maybe that's why I'm a libertarian, is I just don't get the mindset of people like the Obama administration who cannot honestly look into the future and see how this could be abused. They either want it to be abused like that, or they just don't get it. So I don't see there a middle ground there. They're either wanting it to happen or they're just ignorant. It scares the crap out of me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we agree that the Supreme Court can do something about Obamacare. Let's say they pass it. Can the states do anything?
Yes, they can.
Can they nullify?
They could. In fact, the states can nullify a lot.
And they're suing about it, and they are trying to nullify certain parts, and I think you will see states do that, especially.
I just can't see Texas saying, we're going to let Obama tell us to buy health care.
States in the Deep South will start nullifying some of this and saying that you can't require citizens of Alabama to do something. Because, again, remember who created the United States. It was the states. The states convened to create the federal government, and the states control the federal government. That's the way that the system was designed, not the other way around. And we dislodged from that through case law. And when you refer back to case law, that's rule of men as opposed to rule of law. That's why they always talk. What is the amendment that Ron Paul wants to appeal that everybody calls him a racist for? Because basically it's the federal government superseding states' rights.
14th.
The 14th Amendment. Thank you.
If we talk about this in a vacuum and we don't talk about the political history of the United States as far as civil rights, as far as the Civil War, as far as all this kind of stuff, and we just look at it in a legal vacuum at just the Constitution and the way it operates, then it is absolutely 100% plausible and legally justifiable for them to nullify federal law. I'm Thomas Jefferson with the Kentucky Resolution and James Madison with the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions of 1798 and 1799, respectively. They had they set out the legal argument and they got through that. You know, if the federal government passes a law that is contrary to the powers granted to them in the Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution of the United States, the state is not legally bound to exercise it. They are not,
even if the Supreme Court rules that they do.
Even
have that
if
power.
The Supreme Court rules they don't have that power, because that is an arm of the federal government. The argument is, and this is the argument that Thomas Jefferson took. This is the argument that James Madison took up until he was old. And then it was an argument Fugitive Slave Act, they had many fugitive slaves. I mean, for those who don't know, the Fugitive Slave Act said that any slaves that run from the South during the time of slavery and they're found in the North is legally obligated to send them back to the South to go back to their masters. Well, Wisconsin is a great example. They had fugitive slaves, went to Wisconsin, and they didn't send them back. And the Supreme Court even ruled that they had to send them back, and Wisconsin said no. And finally, the federal government just gave up on them. They just said it was just a war of attrition, and Wisconsin won. And it's actually kind of ironic, because if you talk about nullification nowadays, you have this – there is this immediate assumption that you're talking about, you know, it's right-wing extremism. It's, you know, racism, because that's what the South and John C. Calhoun tried to pass and blah, 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 blah. Yet if you look historically at all the times that – nullification has actually been used in American history, they're by and large things that modern liberals would be pretty much okay with, the Fugitive Slave Act being the most obvious. Thomas Jefferson actually tried to embargo, and this is sad to say because he's my favorite founding father, but he was a terrible president. He actually tried to embargo the New England ports because he was fighting – he wanted to fight some – it was some sort of economic warfare on a country that escapes me. But he wanted to embargo New England ports.
I can't believe you forgot that fact. What's wrong with you? You're so stupid.
But he wanted to embargo New England ports, and the New England ports actually used nullification to overturn it, which is actually contrary to the stance they took when Thomas Jefferson tried to nullify the Alien and Sedition Acts, which started the whole concept of nullification in the beginning. So all that historical reference, you know, laid down now. I mean, there is actual legal precedent. There's legal justification under constitutional law that the states have an authority to overturn federal legislation, because you can't look at it as a pyramid. You can't look at it as the federal government on top and the states underneath.
Right.
It's a line. The federal government and the states are equal. It's just what they can rule on are different. It's not like the federal government gets to tell the states everything they can do, and the states have their own little things for whatever they feel like is their – oh, okay, well, the federal government doesn't want to do that, but well, let's do this. No, the states have the right to rule on whatever they are entitled to under constitutional law, and the federal government has, I think it's 18 things that they can make laws about.
If you look at every dollar that Indiana sends to the federal government, we get something like $1.28 back. And when you start serving in state government, you realize how much we depend on the federal government for everything. When I was on the Help America Vote Act Commission, the HAVA Commission, we were trying to decide how to spend $2 million of the federal government's money. And you had to change your entire HAVA plan to make sure that you could get that money. And that applies down to the county, even to the township level. They seek after so much federal money that they totally amend their plans, they amend their laws to make sure that they can get those funds. And the federal government doesn't legally control state and local governments, but they have done it because of money. And if you want to know why the drinking age is 21 in every state, it's because the federal government knew that they couldn't mandate that every state have a drinking age of 21. And so what they did is, I think it was in the 70s, they started saying to every state, you will change your drinking age from 16 up to 21. You will make it 21 so it's consistent in every state in the union. And the states, especially, again, Texas and the Deep South, said, well, we're not going to do that. You can shove it. And the federal government said, okay, well, you're not getting any highway funds. Good luck with your roads. And after about 6 months to a year, every state had a drinking age of 21. And we have become dependent on the federal government for money because state and local governments can't print it. Federal government can print money.
All right. So let's say in Indiana, this goes through the Supreme Court. It's affirmed. Indiana says, we're not going to do it. Then the federal government cuts their aid. And then Indiana says, okay, fine.
You're talking about...
We'll have Obamacare.
Someone, and I'd have to go back and look these figures up, but this was the ballpark. For the $12 billion in revenue that the state generates, they bring in something like $60 billion from the federal government. And so you're talking about cutting... You're talking about cutting government money. You're going from a budget of $80 billion to $12 billion.
So they'd have to.
When we talk about nullification, that's one of the things that doesn't really get talked about, that federal money with the strings attached. And you're talking about an entire culture change. I mean, we have to go from a government-dependent society to a totally reliant society, and understanding that if you were to nullify certain things, you would have to figure out how to pave your own road. You know, it's that intense. That's how deep the federal government is in every aspect of our society. You look around at the products that are in front of you. As I look at the table here, the table, the wood, the finish, the metal in the board that we use, the copper in the wires, the federal government taxes and is in every aspect of regulation in all of those various products. I mean, it's an incredible monster with its tentacles and everything.
It's funny because I always tell people, like when we go on our conferences to various locations for Young Americans for Liberty, I always tell people while we're driving or whatever, play this game, is like, look out the window. Tell me if you can see anything the federal government does not have its hands on.
Mm-hmm.
Anything. And then somebody might point out, oh, well, that might not. Like, I guarantee you there's probably, like, if it's a tree, there's probably a zoning law that has something to do with that tree. There's probably a height regulation on that tree. There's probably a regulation on who can cut that tree.
There's, in Indianapolis, there's code enforcement. And so if you don't cut your lawn, then code enforcement comes in and they cut it for you if it gets above 12 inches.
So we talked about different ways Obamacare can be stopped, basically,
mm-hmm.
Either by the Supreme Court, by state nullification. I want to see if you guys think this is feasible with individuals opting out of the mandate. I've read part of Tom Wood's book, Nullification, and he doesn't specifically talk about individuals nullifying, but I've heard the idea before from him. Have you guys
jury nullification?
Read anything? Well, just, yeah, I guess...
I know the basic concept. We had at last year's state convention, we had someone talk about jury nullification. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the basic concept, I was actually out of the room. The basic concept is that if you're on a jury, you shouldn't convict someone of a crime that you don't feel is constitutional.
Correct. It's basically, even if they're guilty, you rule not guilty based on the constitutionality of the law.
Yeah.
Even if they broke the law.
Right.
So if we, if juries started nullifying Obamacare, basically if someone didn't pay for it or get it and they got taken to court, or they took it to court when they got fined, and the jury ruled that they're not guilty even though they broke the law because the law is unconstitutional, if that kept happening, it would nullify the law.
That would be... Though it would be more of a civil issue because they wouldn't convict you of a crime, I don't think, well, or something that they would take you to jail. They would just send you if Creighton got a speeding ticket, that is actually a civil judgment against you by the city. It's
I
not
was
a
pretty
criminal.
Sure that Obamacare had criminal.
If it is federal,
criminal.
I don't think it matters.
Okay.
It's one. I mean, I'm not a law student, but I'm fairly certain that anything the federal government does has to be within the confines of the Constitution. Obviously, that is not held true at all because the federal code is humongous. But I mean, I'm fairly certain that statutory law is unconstitutional, even if a judge doesn't want to talk about the Constitution.
So if they brought, but this is my question, would you ever go to a jury if they found you guilty of not having insurance, or would they just send you a bill?
Well, you have to pay the
bill.
Well,
if you didn't pay the bill, you...
And that's true. You would end up, if you look like at the Schiff's parent, Ira Schiff, he's in actually Terre Haute, Peter Schiff's dad. Is in Terre Haute for federal tax evasion, for not paying his taxes because he doesn't believe that he should have to.
That's a great thing I was about to bring up. I would say jury nullification is okay. I think what would catch ground much more prevalently. You can edit that out. I think that's okay. I think what would catch ground and people would do more is just general civil disobedience. I mean, the effects of mass action or mass really passivity would be, I mean, if people just by and large just said, I don't care what the law says, I'm not going to buy it. And a lot of people said, well, I'm just not going to buy it. And that caught on, and a lot of people did that. I mean, there's nothing really the federal government can do. You can't arrest everyone in the country. And it's just like what Martin Luther King did. I mean, it's just a mass amount of civil disobedience.
Well, and it's sort of like the example that I just cited. I mean, how many people know that Peter and Andrew Schiff's dad's in Terre Haute in federal prison? He's an 85-year-old man who didn't pay his taxes and isn't in jail because he finds the income tax to be unconstitutional. You can be a martyr for these individual issues, but you have to really have some sort of marketing behind it. You know, I mean, if you look at the Coney people, you've almost got to make an Obamacare denier, if that's what you want to call it. You've got to have a Coney-like marketing team behind you to make sure that people understand what you're being disobedient about. I mean, because if you want to take a proud stand, that's fine, but, you know, get something out of it. I think that's why I like growing the libertarian movement, because it addresses so many multiple injustices. And the more people know about the libertarian philosophy, the more people that we can get. So if you walk into a jury and you try to nullify the law, you're one voice. But if we can spread the libertarian philosophy, then you have a better chance of having more people on the jury who believe like you do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but how do you actually feel about jury nullification? Like,
I think anything that limits the extent and the reach and the power of the state is perfectly fine in my book.
Well, I brought it up because I don't know if you guys heard about the science professor, that 80-year-old science professor that was arrested in New York for standing outside of the courthouse handing out jury nullification papers. Information about it as people went into the courthouse. Well, he was arrested and charged with jury tampering. He wasn't even inside. And the judge on his case said that this would pose a serious threat to the judicial process, and that's why he...
Right. Yeah, it would, because it'd make people actually think.
I mean, that's just a perfect example of, I try. I don't know. I battle with it all the time. It's like, are these people in the government? Are they really just misguided, and they are really have the best intentions, but it just manifests itself in a very bad way? I mean, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, or are they actually like just legitimately, you know, bad people? I mean. Do you think that judge gave it even a half second of thought as to the ends that jury nullification goes for?
I think in that case, if it depends on who you talk to. I mean, most legislators have only good intentions. Okay, judges tend to be more educated; they know more details, and I'm sure that he had heard of jury nullification, and he probably considers it a conspiracy theory.
Well, he said that it would be possible for jurors to
into the mic.
Sorry,
that's okay.
All right, he said that he brought up the possibility that jurors voting to acquit a person based on their beliefs. What happens, such as pro-life protesters who believe that it should be lawful to kill an abortion provider, like an eye for an eye, life for life rule. They would vote for that as a jury if they could do nullification.
That's not how it works, though.
Right. Well, the papers, it's basically, it's not the duty of the jury to uphold the law. It's the duty of the jury to uphold justice.
And that's exactly what jury nullification is. They're pointing out that... You know, I mean, we tend to, like I think I said this on the first podcast, I mean, we live in this, and you said it many times before, we live in this country where we have been so ingrained with the idea that there is, you know, every law is passed by a legislator, it's on paper, and it's all statutory, and it's only lawful if the government, if 50% plus one, pass the law and say it is. It's like, that's how law is made. And, you know, you're really, if you're nullifying a law, especially if you're nullifying it on the basis that it's unconstitutional, I mean, you're really just doing what the legislators failed to do. You're putting the law in the perspective of its constitutional bounds, and you are promoting justice, because it's not justifiable to not have a rule of law. And that's what we don't have a rule of law. Like you said, we have a rule of men. We have a transient opinion that inhabits Washington every so often, changes its opinion and makes pieces of paper that say this is what you have to do. There is no constancy in law, and it's all differently interpreted differently every generation.
Man, he got really worked up on that.
He did.
His arms were flailing, his veins were popping, but you're absolutely right. We're teasing, but you're 100% right. I mean, you know, and the sad thing is that if you tried to nullify, if you were on a jury, if you were, you know, and look up FIJA, F-I-J-A, I think FIJA.org, and the Fully Informed Jury Association will tell you all you need to know about being a fully informed juror. I think most people on the jury would just find you to be a pain in the ass, a kook, somebody who's trying, like, can we just get this over with? If you've ever seen 12 Angry Men, it's that sort of mentality.
Yeah, can we get this over? Let's go home. Right. I'm hungry, and I'm tired of staying
guilty
in this terrible hotel.
Right.
Well, for all the listeners, the case is called U.S. v. Julian Heikkilen, and so you can look it up yourself. It's Julian Heikkilen, H-E-I-C-K-L-E-N.
Okay.
It's a U.S. District Court in New York. And I hope he appeals, because he's facing 6 months in prison.
In federal prison, and we know what Office Space says about that.
Yeah.
So we got about 5 minutes, so we ought to wrap it up here.
Well, we're going to go on to our segment of Idiot of the Week, I think.
Yeah, the only vote was for Idiot of the Week, and the Idiot of the Week is for, apparently nobody liked my suggestion of Douchebag of the Week. We could have played the Jersey Shore theme. but Idiot of the Week is the person who most embarrasses people in the libertarian movement, or who we find shameful in government, somebody who is just generally a total idiot. So who is our Idiot of the Week?
Well, I think our Idiot of the Week is Jason Russell.
Jason Russell. Who is Jason Russell?
Jason Russell is the co-founder of Invisible Children.
Ah, the guy who got caught on film making Invisible Children?
Well, let's just say he's considered a mastermind for his social explosion of Kony 2012. And then a week afterwards, he's found masturbating in public.
You know what's you know what's worse than getting caught masturbating in public? Getting caught masturbating in public on tape that gets posted to TMZ. I mean,
yeah.
My cousin actually went to high school with these guys. And I asked him about it, because they went to high school in San Diego with my cousin, and he said, these beta males, I swear, I always knew that this is exactly how they'd end up. I go, what, masturbating in public? And he goes, exactly.
Well, he was also hospitalized because he was dehydrated.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Dehydrated, drunk, malnourished, and masturbating.
I heard he was vandalizing cars as well.
Right,
he was just being crazy.
Did you see the video?
No, I didn't actually see the video.
I saw the video. I didn't press play, though. I saw it, but I did not hit play.
Well, so that's the Idiot of the Week, I think. Mark
that one down for the history books.
Poor guy. I do feel sorry for him. It's like, you're not going to look back on pride with that one.
Well, to wrap this whole thing up, I guess we can just, Chris Gault and I, are in Young Americans for Liberty, again, not associated with the Libertarian Party.
I know, you're wearing Creighton is wearing his Young Americans for Liberty t-shirt, and Gault is wearing his Students for Liberty t-shirt.
Yep.
Neither of which is affiliated with the Libertarian Party.
or any political activity.
Yes. So, but on campus at IUPUI this week, it has been visualized the debt week for us, which is the long and short of it is that we have a huge display of the debt the national debt on campus, and we stand around a table and have chalkboards with questions that people can answer, questions about the debt, and we just start a general discussion, and we had a pass the mic, which is we had a bunch of people sitting around talking about the issues with a partner organization named Democracy Plaza. And it was really good. So that ends tomorrow.
Anything else happening around the state for young libertarians to attend?
Yeah, well, one of the people on this podcast is running for Secretary of the Undergraduate Student Government.
Oh,
IPUI.
Congratulations, Creighton. It's nice to see that someone smart is going to be involved.
All right, Spangle. No, I'm running, Chris Galt. My Facebook page is facebook.com/ChrisGalt4USG, it's a number 4. And like my page so I can have more likes than all the other candidates and brag about it. And
even if he doesn't win, anything you can help with,
I'm running against 4 people now.
They're real scumbags, so, too, aren't they?
You know, many of them are very hardcore liberals that want to make the government bigger at schools.
So you're secretary, right? So that means you're going to be taking notes and making memos, right?
And communication with
beehive
the school.
Hairdo.
Communication with the school.
Pencil skirt.
I still have the ability to write and legislate. So
Chris called it IPUI. Just a moment.
Okay. But other than that, we have the LPIN State Convention this weekend.
Yes. And actually, thanks to the Libertarian Party of Hendricks County, I have a full student package for one listener of We Are Libertarians. So if you email me at cspangle, or actually just go to the wearelibertarians.com and just post on the wall there that you'd like to take advantage of the package, and I will...
The first person that does gets it for free. Gets to come this weekend for free.
First come.
It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Right, and it's all access. We'll give you lunch.
You get to meet Gary Johnson, get to meet us.
You'll get to meet Rupert. Food. You'll get to meet Andy Horning. You'll get to meet Chris Galt.
A lot of people with bow ties.
No one. I don't think anybody's going to be wearing bow ties.
Are you sure? Because every time I go to these kind of things, there's always a dude in a bow tie.
That is Ron Paul Republicans. They're the weirdos, not the Libertarian Party. Libertarian Party members are not weird, right, Galt?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. I don't anticipate any bow ties, but if there are, take your picture with them and post it on the Facebook page, and then we'll all just sort of snicker together.
And please give us questions that we can answer on the show. We don't want to talk about what we want to talk about. Right. We want to talk about what you want to hear. So,
and where can I ask those questions, Mr. Galt?
Well, on the Facebook page, of course.
Why?
Or the Twitter. Tweet it to us. Tweet
where
us a question.
Where can I find those?
Well, on Facebook.com/WeAreLibertarians or just WeAreLibertarians.com.
You guys talked over each other and it sounded like Internet/WeAreLibertarians, of course.
And then our Twitter handle is WeAreLibertarians with the letter R instead of A-R-E.
Right.
So
go to WeAreLibertarians.com.
Let us know how we're doing.
Well, we don't really want you. No,
okay. Don't, well, just give us questions.
If you have nothing nice to say, don't say it at all.
There you go.
So, all right.
And just to drill it into everyone's head again, on April 21st up at Purdue, there will be an event with Tom Woods, Purdue Young Americans for Liberty, and the Intercollegiate Studies Institute with various other speakers. Make sure you register for that a week in advance because that's the cutoff date. Just go to the isi.org and look at their events page and find the event. It's on April 21st at Purdue University. You can register at their website. It'll be really fun, really good, really informative, and everyone should go because I said so. Well, in conclusion, this has been, I think, a relatively accomplishing podcast. It was a little bit better than the first one, I think.
And definitely better than last week.
I actually have not been able to listen to the entire podcast from last week.
Yeah, we had to redo last week's podcast. And it just was so, we recorded it at the normal time, and it just was so awkward without you there, because obviously Creighton's the one who knows stuff. So
hey, we know stuff, Spangle.
We know stuff about politics. He's the one who, like, who can do 15 minutes on, like, Gibbons versus America or whatever.
I knew what it was, but I couldn't talk that long about it.
I know. He's like, obviously the Kentucky Resolutions of 1793. You're like, oh, my God.
98.
Yeah, excuse me. I'm sorry.
There you go.
So
that's great.
So we actually redid it. So we want to thank everybody for listening to We Are Libertarians. This is a weekly podcast. Please go on Facebook, share the podcast with your friends, help us grow, and like us and rate us on iTunes so we can raise our profile there too. Thank you for listening. This is We Are Libertarians with your host, Chris Spangle, Chris Galt, and Creighton Harrington.
Taking over.
Hello, check one, two, check.
So I decided there's something else you need to do.
What?
You need to make all of our mics different channels.
Why?
So then you can edit our voices solo.
You can make me sound like Barry White.
You know, separately.
You should put an auto-tune on it. Be like, hey, welcome to We Are Libertarians.
Yeah, you should mess with the speed or something in the beginning. Or the end.
The Chipmunk song, huh? Alvin!
Okay! You guys.
This podcast is produced by What is a Hoosier Productions.